Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters with Mitchell Davis. I'm your host. That is he, Mitchell Davis. And every week at 11 o'clock, we have an interesting conversation, or a conversation I hope you find interesting, about taste. And today is an unusual conversation. Unusual, actually, that's not true at all. It's a very familiar conversation. But the question of what to do on this day on a food radio program on Yom Kippur, which happens to coincide with what would have been my mother's 78th birthday, were she still with us. The idea from a cousin of mine to come onto the show and talk about food in our family in some ways, because I come to food, you might say naturally, or at least in our extended family, had a piece of history in New York in several restaurants through my cousins. One of them was Cousin Mickey Ruskin, who's Max's Kansas City, one of the great restaurants, although it's not known for its food or for anything that was consumed there. Well, maybe some things that were consumed there, but not exactly eaten necessarily. And the other, Madeline Poli's Soho Charcuterie. And Madeline, my cousin Madeline, is with me in the studio, and we're so excited to have you here. Welcome.
Thanks, Mitchell. Great to be here.
And last week, we actually had an interesting show with Pete Wells, the restaurant critic for the New York Times, and he was talking about a very, I don't know if it's controversial, but almost a sad review of the restaurant Le Cirque, which is a restaurant that opened in the 70s and went on to become a certain category of place that continues to this day if you go into the dining room. And at the same time, Madeline, you had opened a restaurant in a very different place, in a very different type of restaurant, in a neighborhood that you said today reminds you a little bit of Bushwick here, called Soho. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, first of all, the first time I ever worked in a restaurant was when I owned one. And I have absolutely no idea, having had no real, you know, talking about our family. I mean, there are some, I was talking to our cousin Phyllis, and her greatest memory of food was what was called Jewish spaghetti. I don't know if it made its way to
you. Of course, I love Jewish spaghetti. It's in my cookbook.
And it had to be Del Monte tomato sauce.
And creamette noodles or something, elbow noodles. Of course, absolutely. That was a family classic. We described Jewish spaghetti, though.
So it shows you the level of
well, but
culinary.
Wait a second. Have you had it lately? It's pretty delicious.
I actually haven't had it lately, but after talking to Phyllis, you know, I've just been craving it, and it's on my agenda, except I do it with spaghetti.
Okay, so Jewish spaghetti, just for those of you at home, was classically elbow macaroni, Hunt's tomato sauce, butter, and sugar, and
we'll go down to the wire on this. It's supposed to be Del Monte's.
Del Monte, sorry, Del Monte. Okay. Maybe they didn't have it in Canada, anyway.
Okay, so you know, mine is a long history, so I'll make it as brief as possible. I did not remember coming from a food, you know, food was, you know, more holiday kind of things. Mm-hmm. My mother made the chopped liver, Aunt May made the fantastic cream cheese cookies, mm-hmm. and, you know, but that was more special occasion. On every day type of food, it was my mother would wake me up at, you know, to go to school and say, what do you want for dinner? And I'd say, how do I know what I want for dinner? She said, but it's so easy. There's only three choices.
Right.
Chicken, lamb chops, or steak, you know, or frozen dinners, or God knows. So anyway, speed forward. I landed up living in Paris for a while, and I remember, and I think this is what brings Mickey in a lot. And Mickey and I grew up across the street from each other, Mickey Ruskin. And
another cousin.
Well, Max is Kansas City. And he he was just, you know, the biggest thing was to go to the out for steak. Mm-hmm. And my farewell meal before I went to France, well, I landed up in France, but I started somewhere else, was I remember getting a filet mignon, split and well done. Speed forward, you know, to living in France, the first French word I learned was bien cuit.
Right. For well done, to get that steak well done, yes.
So, obviously, it started to have an effect on me. You know, the food was, you know, shopping every day for, you know, I was a student and, you know, couldn't afford a lot of things. And I remember some French friends we made francs and beans for. Anyway, came back, got into student exchange and, you know, sending students over to Europe. And we had an office in Paris, so I made frequent trips back and forth. So food started to, you know, become primary for mm-hmm. me, but not as a profession. Mm-hmm. And I, you know, back in New York, I met a friend who was... I met somebody who became a friend. She was a young chef, untrained, and she. There was a place called Mother Courage, which was very famous. It was like a feminist hangout, mm-hmm. Gloria Steinem, and she lived across the street, and she would cook things in her apartment, take it over there. We eventually teamed up. Mm. I was still working, and actually, I had set up an apprenticeship for her with some friends of mine who had a restaurant in Saint-Germain, and she was going to go over there and study. So to save money, because these estages don't pay anything, mm-hmm. She decided to move in with me, and I was living in Chelsea, which mm-hmm. is, you know, I have her... back and forth for many years, and there was a little store for rent, and it was I just said, gee, wouldn't it be great to do kind of a little French charcuterie, which mm-hmm. this was 1973, and it was pretty unheard of then.
Sure. Whereas now, charcuterie, you can't swing a cat without hitting a saucisson, right, or something, right. but
we would do sandwiches, right. and stuff like that, and I think if anything goes on my tombstone, which I'm never going to have a tombstone, but it will be that I created Black Forest ham and brie sandwich.
Okay.
It's when I was bored. I have nothing to do, so I take a little bit of this, a little bit of that, and that's it. So speed forward, you know, there was no kitchen there. We cooked in our, you know, in my apartment, and we got evicted.
Mm-hmm.
And
for cooking in your apartment,
abusive cooking, and we had to find another space, and then we had no money. Mm-hmm. We landed up finding a place in Soho on the corner of Spring and Sullivan, and it was a mess. It was an old Italian restaurant, and we raised a little money. We managed to put the thing together with financing and getting mm-hmm. some money from friends, and we opened. And
that's 1975 in Soho.
That was 1975 in Soho.
Where no one would come to dinner.
Right.
Like Bushwick, for instance.
Exactly.
Like Bushwick, right.
I remember we were sitting in the dining room staring at the only one customer eating dinner. You know, there was...
right.
And we were about to go under, but fortunately we got discovered by the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
And got a full-page review.
Wow.
And kind of the rest became...
history.
History, mm-hmm. you know?
And so, what was it then? Like, what do you think was... what were you doing? Let's talk a little bit about the food. And you wrote a great cookbook, actually, which when I Amazoned it is still easy to find. There's mm-hmm. plenty of copies, and it's a great book.
I think what I kind of want to just mention is that you know, without going back into history mm-hmm. about old restaurants, what we were doing in the 70s is very similar to what is going on today.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there weren't as many resources, but you know, we would go to, we'd get in our VW van and go out to New Jersey to the dairy farm and, you know, get fresh milk. And by the time we got back to the city, it practically turned into butter. We'd go out to the farms on the, you know, the North Shore and, you know, get vegetables and bring them back. And I remember one time I very rarely got to take much of a vacation. I went up to the Cape, and on my way back, I got a cooler and loaded up all kinds of wonderful, you know, shellfish, and speeded back to the city, and, you know, it was on the menu for lunch. Right. And we would take, we were very, because I did a lot of traveling, we were very kind of globally influenced, but in kind of my partner was Francine Shearer, was really more the Syria chef, you know. I was sort of running the business and landed up doing mainly lunch and brunch, and you know, so I was more interested in sort of comfort foods, you know, but in an interesting form, more of a.
But there was a. But I think that's really interesting, actually, that, that we're in a moment now that resonates with that time for you. Even the DIY, you weren't a trained chef. You hadn't. You neither of you had run a restaurant before. It wasn't an empire of restaurants. It was two people working really hard, long hours, making something work in a way that, that, you know, Brooklyn has come to stand for today.
Right.
In, a lot of people have never done this before. Certainly not something like this. Do you think there's? Do you think we've learned anything? I mean, you now live in Brooklyn, and do you think when you go out to restaurants, or is it great that you think that that's sort of the thing that has sustained, and while all these trends have come and gone, and food has gotten high and short, and people have spent $15 million on restaurants and other, you know, do you see something today that... that
I definitely see something today. I see, I remember at the... end of the, I wrote the introduction to the cookbook, and one of the last sentences I did before the editor edited some other things into it was that, you know, even an omelet can be noble, you know, and whether it be a sandwich or it's using one's, what I think is so exciting today is watching people use their creativity, whether it be a great sandwich. Or it be something far more exotic, you know. Or, you know, to me, it's exciting to watch. Although I think it's absolutely mind-boggling what's going on in the food world today.
Right.
You know.
How I mean, so?
Well, I mean, food is the new Hollywood.
Right, right. You can't get away from it. I was telling someone the other day that even though I'm obsessed with food and restaurants and cooking, I can't believe that I can't open a magazine or turn on a TV show and not see someone talking about food, introducing a chef or something. It's so different. I remember, I don't even know if I've told you the story, but we worked at the Beard Foundation with a great editor, Peggy Gradinsky, who's now at America's Test Kitchen. And one day, she was a bit of a pack rat, and she was cleaning up some stuff in her parents' house, and she brought an old New York Times magazine to show me how different the recipes were at that time. And she, that's why she brought the, it was a 1980 entertaining edition of the New York Times magazine. And who was on the cover? But I looked... She handed it to me, and there you were. You were on the cover, one of the chefs on the cover, and also had some of the recipes inside. Do you think? Do you think we eat differently or appreciate different things now than we did then, or do you think?
Well, you know, growing up, you know, eating out was special occasion. Today, it's almost everyday entertainment. You know, and I think that, well, I go off onto a tangent. I know, you know, this whole thing that I find very upsetting today is the celebrity chef thing. And, you know, there are so many good, talented people out there, you know. And I think that's why I also love, you know, the name of your program, Taste Matters. And it doesn't really matter what it is.
Right.
As long as it's good.
As long as it's good.
Today,
right.
Recipes are very different. They have to be very quick, you know, like three, four steps. You know, I come from a world of cooking that it was probably 4 pages of a recipe, and one of the greatest honors we ever had at the charcuterie, besides having James Beard as a regular customer, was Julia Child. You know, and she, you know, her recipes were complicated, but they were tried and true.
Yeah, they worked. Well, and we've gotten to a place where we've turned cooking into a chore almost by emphasizing fast, easy, quick, whatever. A few weeks ago, we had Tamar Adler on the show, who's written a great book called The Everlasting Meal. And she said, just because time is not difficult. We don't have a lot of it sometimes, but things that take time aren't more complicated. They just take some time necessarily. You know, right. If a stew has to cook for 4 hours, that's not 4 hours of hard work. That the stove is doing the work. The meat is doing the work.
Right.
Time is not, we've created a scarce resource of time in our food somehow, and made things seem like they need to be simpler when they weren't that complicated in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back, and we'll talk a little bit about some of the other restaurants in the family.
You're listening to the Elbow Room Sessions by Bohemia, heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins from Fairway Markets. I've devoted my idiot career to the old ways, the old recipes, the old tools, the old geography of where serious foods come from for centuries. And I've strived to make these wonderful things available to New Yorkers for 37 years, so it's a fait accompli for us to support Heritage Radio Network. And I hope you will too, and I hope you'll keep tuning in. For more information, please visit fairwaymarket.com.
Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm Mitchell Davis, and I'm talking with my cousin Madeline Poli, who was the chef and proprietor, co-chef and co-proprietor of the Soho Charcuterie. And we are talking about, or keeping it in the family, or our family culture. And maybe that's not interesting to anybody out there, but you're listening. And if you have any questions about restaurants in New York over the ages, or about some of the similarities of what happened in the 70s and 80s here versus what's going on now, you can call us at 718-497-2128 with your questions. You can email us at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Or if you're listening to the podcast, or you just prefer Twitter as a means of communication, tweet us at Taste Matters HRN. So let's move to the other cousin. Let's move to the other cousin restaurateur, Mickey Ruskin, who, you know, is a legend in my life. I maybe met him once or twice when I was very young, but he died young. But he had some restaurants that people won't seem to ever forget. And it isn't, as we said, for the food. Max's Kansas City among them. But I just learned he had sometime 8 restaurants in total in New York.
Well, originally, we were going to have Victoria Ruskin on, and she's working on a film in Savannah. So she's Mickey's daughter,
right?
You know, and I counted up. I think I'm pretty accurate that he had 8 restaurants, but there was nothing like Max's,
right?
And the heyday of Max's was the '60s and the '70s, and it was on a strip on Park Avenue South that nobody went to.
It was nowhere,
absolutely bleak territory.
Right.
And You know,
nobody except everybody went to Max's. No one went to that neighborhood. But, you know, I this morning's friends were telling me, have I read Patti Smith's biography? Because 3/4 of it happens
at
in Max's, Kansas City.
Well,
yeah.
And Andy Warhol,
yeah.
You know, he, you know, held court in the back room.
Right.
And
so you were there, I presume?
I was there, yeah. You know. Wasn't often let into the back room.
Right. But let's talk about the food for a second. What did they serve?
Basic thing at Max's was steak, lobsters, and I remember one of the things that I liked, he would always give a big wooden bowl of salad, a tossed salad. It was a good salad. And then you would get this lazy Susan that was always tipping over of salad dressings.
Oh, I remember those. I didn't know they had one.
Yeah.
Fun.
And they were good dressings. You know, the steak was pretty, good. It was a good quality steak.
Right.
But one of probably the most famous thing that he had was his signature thing with the dried chickpeas on the table.
Oh.
And, of course, everyone drank madly. Mm-hmm. And so the chickpeas became... like everybody used to throw them at each other. I don't know if anyone ever ate them, but they certainly, you know, became, you know, a game. And it was, I mean, Rauschenberg was there. You know, of course, Patti Smith,
right.
You know, name every de Kooning, you know. I remember Mickey had a house up in Great Barrington, and John Chamberlain was doing his stuff in his garage,
oh my God.
You know. And I saw a tab of a restaurant tab that Andy Warhol had given Mickey a painting or a silkscreen to cover
his check.
Uh-huh. check. And that's where a lot of the art, you know, happen because...
Well, and you sent me a link on YouTube that I actually tweeted, if you follow me on Kitchen Sense, of a very young Bruce Springsteen performing in 1972 at Kent Max's.
Right. Well, he opened up the upstairs and that became a club and that became a whole other thing.
Mm-hmm. And... so not a lot of families have famous restaurateurs, things that sort of...
or famous scholars, wonderful such as yourself. And,
thanks. You often hear, and I'm a real detractor from this idea, and I know you said that food wasn't an important part, although in our life, in our family... food was important for the family because my mother loved to cook, and it was really how she did express love, and we all have sort of warped relationships with food. And even if she wasn't the greatest chef in the world, her food was always delicious. But we heard stories of her grandmother, your grandmother, my great-grandmother, who made things that, you know, my mother regretted not eating later in life. Chopped liver was one, although she grew to love that, but gefilte fish and things that kids didn't want but apparently were amazing, and people used to rave over Ava's X, Y, and Z.
Well, one of the funny stories about the chopped liver, you know, it was fantastic chopped liver, and nobody could figure out what was just so special about it. And the secret ingredient was a dollop of Hellman's mayonnaise.
There you go.
There it's out. It's out in the world, you know.
Well, and now David Chang is cooking with Kewpie mayonnaise from Japan and plus ça change. But do you think there's any... so you often hear in bios in press releases, you know, this chef learned to cook at his grandmother's knees, and we have a narrative that we like to believe is true, that good cooks and good lovers of food come out of food-loving families. And my experience in the world is not that necessarily. I mean, sure, that can happen, but a lot of great cooks grew up eating food out of boxes like we all did. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, rice-a-roni was a treat in our family in addition to some of the other things my mother made. But also that, you know, good food is made with love, which I think is a bit of a crock because I know a lot of assholes who make delicious food, you know. Do you have any thoughts about these, the relationship, the stories we tell ourselves about what makes food good?
I mean, going back, I mean, as I'm sure you do, I have certain comfort food buttons that, you know, inspire me. But I don't think, you know, I mean, a Jewish family, the food is supposed to be the centerpiece.
Mm, you know? Right.
I'm not certain I really had any real interest in food.
At all.
At all, hmm. You know? I mean, I enjoyed, you know, the holiday kind of thing.
But, right.
You know, I don't think my background, although it was the occasions of getting together.
Right.
I think. And the Nastor sisters were, you know, all... would, you know, each one would bring something to the table, basically.
Right.
And,
so my grandmother, your mother, were the mm-hmm. Nastor sisters, and there were mm-hmm. four of them.
Very strong-minded yeah. women.
Yes, each with some specialty in the kitchen.
I wanted to get one story in uh-huh. that is, you know, you grew up, in Detroit, and then...
Toronto.
And
yeah.
Toronto. So we never really, you know, knew each other that well till later. But the story, if you want to tell it about
that. Sure, please.
You had, I don't know about how old you were.
I think I was 11 or 12.
11 or yeah. 12. And your grandmother, I think Rose mm-hmm. was there, and your mother came over to the restaurant with you.
Mm-hmm. For brunch. It was Sunday
brunch.
For brunch
or something. And... your mother, Sonny, said to me, Madeline, could you please talk to Mitchell? You know, he has this thing in his mind that he wants to be a chef. And he will be poor for the rest of his life. And I just looked at her and I said, you're asking me this question?
I'm a chef. Right.
So, you know, it just was like one of those, I don't know what she expected to say. Right. I'm running a restaurant, I'm a chef.
But how different? I mean, I talk about that a lot. I mean, however much we hate the idea of the celebrity chef or feel it's a complicated idea, you know, not that chefs aren't, certain people aren't worthy of celebrity, but celebrity doesn't mean you can cook well. That I think that's the part that's the problem, but however much, however complicated we find that situation we're in, part of the consequence of that is that now it's okay to be a chef. I don't think my mother would have to ask you that question today, were she around, because kids see them everywhere. The Beard House is now in a partnership with the State Department called the Diplomatic Culinary Partnership, and I think to myself, this was unthinkable when I wanted to be a chef, when you had a restaurant.
Exactly.
We just cooked food, you know?
Right.
And we perhaps felt at the time it wasn't just food, but the world has caught up and gone wacky mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. Now food, we joke because of the State Department thing in my home that they're going to send us to Iran to see what we can do over there. You know, maybe a good rice dish will make everyone love each other as part of Washington's new diplomatic culinary partnership that mm-hmm. we're involved in. And yet, I mean, one of the things that Hillary Clinton said in the video when they presented this relationship we have now with the Beard Foundation was the oldest form of diplomacy is sitting down at the table breaking bread with people, and in some ways that's, you know, you that's what those memories of family are about. That's what those holiday meals, I mean, even if you wanted to kill each other by the time you got to the end of the meal, the memory of the coming together, I think, is part of what resonates with people about around food and mm-hmm. around eating. We have to get in that after one of the most recent food projects you put on, don't have much time to talk about it, and you probably don't want to, but just to show that it wasn't all about French charcuterie and things, that New York Burger Company was your concept that you created.
Right.
And sort of took this idea that sandwiches and burgers don't have to be junk food and mm-hmm. can be not even just well-sourced, but actually well-prepared with all sorts of fun things about it. And I think that reflects a little bit what you were saying about we're in a moment that started then and hasn't really changed. I mean, food can be good at every level, whatever we're enjoying. Mm-hmm. I think Roberta's is a perfect example of that. You know, it's a place that a pizzeria that has grown to be a farm, to be a 22 course tasting menu in the back that they built themselves
it's amazing.
Restaurant. Yeah.
Just going on a tour here was fantastically amazing.
Yeah, and that spirit, I think, that spirit hasn't changed, even mm-hmm. though all of these things have happened and Top Chef has happened and the Beard Foundation is 25 years old. Do you have any memories while we're here about James Beard? Something you can tell us that?
Well, there was... James Beard often came to the restaurant, mm-hmm. fortunately, and we had just gotten a ice cream making machine, and where he was sitting, which was called Table One, was right near the trapdoor with the produce was being delivered. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to him, and I said, he said, "What do you have special for dessert?" And I said, and I saw a flat of raspberries coming through, and I said, "How about a raspberry sorbet?" He said, "Fantastic." And we hadn't even gotten the machine working yet. But we pulled it together.
The freshest raspberries,
had
right?
His raspberry sorbet.
The freshest raspberry sorbet he ever had.
Probably anyone has ever had.
And on that note, I think we'll conclude our Yom Kippur family show, reminiscing with my cousin Madeline Poli, who you've started a blog now and people can follow you. What's the blog address?
Well, I've just started it, so it's called noshingonbrooklyn.wordpress.com.
Okay, so go be an early, a charter reader of Madeline Poli's blog. Next week we have Peter Kaminsky, who has written many, many cookbooks with a lot of chefs and done all sorts of food things for New York Magazine, but has an interesting book out called Culinary Intelligence, which is a thing I think that we live by, a way of managing your weight by eating well and not by dieting, quote unquote, and a whole philosophy about food. It's a philosophy we share. You're listening to Taste Matters, and eat something delicious.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.